What I'm going to do is set the scene a little bit by trying to put my talk in context for this particular discussion. I'm then going to make some remarks about how we think about a particular instance of stuff that can be called information. And then I'm going to talk and play with some technologies that we devised to argue and show, and I might demonstrate, that we have to be careful when we think about a particular concept. So, yesterday quite a few people remarked on this dude, very near where I work, and most of it was this: concepts are understood in terms of their use. This is the undergraduate introduction to Wittgenstein, and I know you don't want to read the Philosophical Investigations. This is their view of his ontology, or if you like, his epistemology, his understanding of what concepts are to be understood, namely, in the context of use. Understand doings, understand meaning. Those of you who have read the Philosophical Investigations will know that's a byproduct of his argument. His first argument and his sole concern is something else. It's about diligence. It's about care. It's about the problems of thinking carefully with clarity and without doing something else, which is this: the stretching of concepts. Rather pedantic interpretation to Wittgenstein. So you should stick vigorously to all concepts, you think, if you have a carefully argued. He says, no. Make concepts work for you, but think carefully about how you do that. So, let's take some examples of stretching. Information, is it? What kind of a concept is it? I'm going to remark briefly. This isn't the substance of my talk, I'm framing it. Two concerns with stretching. The first is sense. Do concepts all have the same form? Some concepts, Wittgenstein argues, are a little bit peculiar. They're different from other concepts. Some concepts, for example, are things that do labelling. They bundle things. Other concepts are concepts that let you do other things. One of those concepts is, for example, the concept of truth. A peculiar property of truth is that it makes no sense to ask what truth is in the general. If you had to ask that, you would have to be a Martian. You would not be able to use language, English language, all the languages which use veracity as a key principle. You learn that truth is a concept you use in the particular. Is this true? Was she lying? Was he fibbing? If I interpret it this way, do I get to the truth? You can't define truth in the general. It makes no sense to. It suggests that you're autistic. Wittgenstein's phrase is to suggest that if you had defined what truth meant in the abstract, you have something wrong with you. His phrase was sickness of the mind. Now, likewise, how might this apply for something like the concept of information? Is it just the same as the concept of truth? No, clearly not. It has different properties. But if you think about the care with which he illustrates what truth might be, likewise, one might want to be careful when we use the concept information. So yesterday, for example, Chris's talk was, I thought, an excellent examination, not of the attempt to define information, but to say, in this context, this is what information is. And what it turned out to be is that information is not mathematical formula, it's the curious and wonderful magical drawings of electrical engineers. That's what information is there. He didn't need to define information in the abstract. He said, look, this is what we do when we do with information. These are examples of it. Now, whether Chris is right or wrong, I don't know. That's an arcane matter, foreign to me. Now, second form of stretching, the problem of reductionism. You can reduce things. You can reduce concepts into sub-concepts. You can reduce objects into lesser objects. Reductionism is, of course, fairly elemental in some trades, in science, of course. It can also be hugely useful. Think of Shannon's topic. The opening gamble of his famous paper with Weaver was, let's reduce all sorts of information types into something less. Let's, for example, in the opening page, get rid of semantics. Let's just treat communication
as stuff. Reductionism worked for him. I should come back to that in a little bit. The trouble with reductionism is it's like, and not all concepts, it has peculiar properties. One of the peculiarities is it's quite useful sometimes to reduce things in certain sorts of ways. Sometimes it isn't. But when it is sometimes useful, it's not necessarily also useful to go from the reduction back upwards. Take human communication. You can reduce this to any type of information. My car signals to various sensors in my lab. I signal to my wife. If I signaled to my wife, she'd probably be a little vexed. Why are you signaling to me? Am I merely a machine, man? Or are you my husband? Do you show affection? Or is it all that I get? In other words, there might be something different at issue. So when you reduce, in one instance, reducing, you're taking the reductionism to reduct it back up to the thing reduced from, might suddenly lose some important vitality. And this leads me to the substance. And what I'm going to talk about here is human communication and how you explore it. This is the book that I'm going to talk about. And I'm going to do this in a kind of perambula and come back. What I'm going to talk about is how my colleagues and and I tried to deal with communication, human communication. Is human communication to be understood in the way that Shannon proposes? Not Weaver necessarily, but Shannon, just as information. If so, what would you innovate? What would be the things that came to mind? How would you engineer it? So my point of view here is not the philosophical problem of what is information, but the practical engineering problem of enabling something. The thing in question is an exchange of information. In this instance, it's communications between persons. So, 15 years ago, no, alas, 20 years ago, I worked at Xerox. And there we were tasked to reinvent communication. And the reason why we wanted to reinvent communication or to enable new forms of communication was that then it was thought that knowledge work, which is a kind of phrase you don't hear so much these days, Zuboff's magic has kind of waned, was becoming distributed. And if some workers were here in Milton Keynes, other workers were in Cambridge. Separated by distance, how might you bring them together? So our task was to invent technologies that could let them do what? Communicate, produce information. What was it we engineered first of all? We engineered shared editors. And shared editors were fantastically simple things. On a distributed network, in this instance, Lisp machines, then moved on to X, Windows machines, some machines, you could have a window. And the window was shared. So basically, one machine would look through its over the network to a window actually stored, run on another machine. And you could put a cursor into that editor, into that window, and start typing. The person elsewhere could see that typing. If you started typing, you would start typing immediately. But the goal was you had a shared editor. This was thought to be the future of knowledge work. You could write, he could write, he could write, I could see it, we could edit it together. Now, you can imagine certain things would create problems without some refinement. For example, who's going to talk next? Who's going to type next? Well, after a little while, it solved itself fairly straightforwardly. I would type, press stop. Nothing would happen. The other person would think, oh, it's my go, typing away. What do you think happened to that technology? Nothing. We thought it was incredibly boring. Why did we think it was incredibly boring? We thought it was incredibly boring because we had this idea that information exchange between persons, would be better if there was more. Text seems little. Text seemed like letting people do talk over a mobile phone when you could have a video phone. If you had a choice, surely you'd want the video phone. If we were engineering the future and we were starting with text, surely something else would be better. What would that better be? It would be video connections, media spaces. But before I talk a little bit about our experience of that, what do you think happened to shared editors? How many of you, none of you in fact here now because of the network, but most of you will use instant messaging. Instant messaging is one of the most remarkable successes of communications technology. But no interest is shown in it by the people who first invented them. A long way went from that to this. But the big egos, me, all of us who have devised these things, thought, oh, this is trash. Who could possibly want it? The fact that it's now a key tool for teenagers, for example, even my boss instant messaged me. He thinks it's a tool for making intimacy with colleagues. It's a bit creepy, but nevertheless, it's a commonplace thing. Now, let me move on quickly. Media space. More is better. At Xerox, I'm trying to cover a lot of ground. We thought seeing would be better. So we put, this, don't forget, it's 20 years ago, TVs and big cameras and then coaxial cable between every single office. Miles of cable, 68 miles, if I think it was, of coaxial cable, a lot of money. And you can make video connections between everybody. Did we use them? What was the use? What was the fate of them? Well, what you found was when you did studies of work, collaborative work, you found that actually people didn't care to look at their colleagues writing the paper. They just wanted the colleagues to write the paper. When you finished it, can you come and give it to me? The colleagues, meanwhile, will say, stop looking at me. I'm just writing the paper. Why do you want to look at me? What are you gaining from looking at me? What are we gaining by sharing an office space, making a video connection, if we're meant to be doing knowledge work? Well, it turns out that knowledge work, like most work, exists around a division of labor. It's your turn. Now it's my turn. It's your turn. Sometimes, of course, you would want to share and argue and discuss things. Sometimes we would use a media space to confer. But it turns out very infrequently. One of the things that some of our researchers thought might be the trick would be that when we looked into these TV cameras, TV screens and the cameras, because the camera was here on a tripod, we couldn't buy little ones, big things, and the TV monitor was here, when I looked at my colleague in another office, I would be looking there, the camera would be over here, so he would see me not looking at you, but looking over here. I think I'm looking at you, but you're actually here. You're looking at me through a camera. But the trouble is, when I look at you, then I'm not looking at you. And now likewise, when you're looking at me, you're not actually looking at me, you're looking at the camera. So both of us in the video space would be looking past one another. Some people thought that if the problem with human communication is to do with fitting, and one way you'd fit it is by getting people's eyes to glance, to see together, to glance into each other's eyes. If information is about more, if human communication is about more, when I gaze, surely we can do that intellectual work, that sharing together. So we built a thing called video tunnels, which was basically like a periscope with boxing and cardboard, so that it looked as if I was looking into the screen, looking into the camera when I was looking at the screen. And we built these, did some tests for 2 weeks, and that was it. We put them away. They were very ugly, took up a lot of space. And as it happened, I didn't want to look into the eyes of my collaborator. In fact, my collaborators thought it a bit creepy, that I thought this was a beneficial thing to do. Why are you looking at me like that, Richard? You know, is there an agenda here? As it happened, some colleagues did have an agenda. There's a couple that, now no longer a couple, flourished as a couple through exploring the media space. And that might tell something about the characteristics of human information. But anyway, let me rush on. 10 years, probably not 10 years. C-Slate. This is a Microsoft. Here, come up with this idea that if we have a video conferencing system, we can do pretty good visuals. We can see people. We can share stuff. We can even share documents over SharePoint. I can have a document. You can have a document. But I can't get to grips. I can't touch the documents. So can we devise a system whereby I can pick up a piece of paper, a document, say, these stuff here, and I can glance, show it. That's fine, you can do that in most video systems. But what would it be if I could say, do that, and what my movement there is conveyed onto an electric document, which is affecting his electric document. So as I touch here and manipulate and work with a document, so those gestures are conveyed through space in real time to raise document, so that I can use my hands to touch the ideas, the information. It's called C-Slate. Won a paper award, believe it or not. Now, what did we do that then? What happened with that particular application was, well, no one in the lab wanted to use it. We paid some people to come in to use it and did some speed tests and usual trials, got a good paper out of it. As soon as that was done, it was packed away. No one thought of using it. No one wanted to use it with our colleagues, for example, in Redmond. Why would I want to do that, they said. Ordinary people would use it, but not us. Oh, okay. I wonder who those ordinary people are. So, what we have in summary is the idea that human communication is to be understood as exchange of information, but the exchange of information is bound up with something to do with human bodies. Two bodies are separated by space. Why would you want to communicate? Because you want to bring the bodies together. How might you do that? Transform that bodily movement, the bodily sense of presence, into some digital form and fit the bodies together. So, in one vision, we had the idea of fitting glances together. In the other vision, we had the idea of fitting hands together, touches. This isn't just my companies, the stuff I've kind of been concerned with. Think of Google Wave. Are any of you familiar with that particular application? Yeah. It's the same idea. Instantness, intimacy, bodies. Now, as it happens, information communication, you have to reduce it oftentimes, and the machine metaphor is the typical one. I'm going to just pause for a minute, and I'm going to show you a video. And the purpose of this video is to... make you think about two things. One, that reducing content types, reducing, in this instance, human communication into something else, has great value for certain sorts of instances, for certain sorts of tasks. I can get this to work. But also, to make you think what it is. Are we ready to go?
And into this kind of business is the unusually permissive atmosphere and the interest in ideas. But their work isn't all desk work, as shown by this experiment on the attention span needed for safe driving. The experimenter is a branch director, psychologist John Sanders.
Driving along a section of Route 128, and I'm trying to get an estimate of the demand by this particular section of road. The speed of the car is constant, and as the road varies from moment to moment in the demand that it makes upon me, I must look more often or less often, as the case may be. The visor completely occludes my view during the period that it's down, and I must rely on some stored image or memory of what the road was before the visor went down. The half-second look that I have is enough to restore all the information that I should need in order to drive down the road. The records that we get of the time between looks at the road give us a direct measure of the difficulty presented to the driver by the road from moment to moment as we drive down it. The shorter the interval between looks, the more difficult that segment of road is to drive. On those periods, as you saw, where the interval was very long, the road was indeed easy. The interval then gives us a direct and quantitative measure of this rather elusive thing called difficulty.
Now, let me explain. First, that is real science. This is someone really driving in Boston with a contraption, and the contraption is controlled by his foot. And what he's doing is he's pressing his foot when he needs to see, taking his foot off when he doesn't need to see. And the concern is Bateson's concern is to investigate information processing. And in this instance, visual data processing. How quickly can you process visual information? How much do you need? What's the relationship between that and difficulty, load, burdens? That work by John Sanders, although it wasn't published, is in fact canonical in ergonomics and in the design of transport systems, still cited, still reviewed, even though that seems rather bizarre. My point here is to suggest... thinking about communication, thinking about information, communicating content externally, bringing it in, reducing it as an information concept into just data really is useful, really can get you somewhere. It really can let you engineer some things. It really can let you ask some things, but not always. It can also, if you misunderstand it, muddle you. Those of you who've read Shannon and Weaver know that there's some tension between whether that Shannon and Weaver, where those two authors were interested in just information or semantics, for example. Think of this dude. What's his book about? What's the last chapter of his book? The whole thing about his book, Cybernetics, is that we are just information processes. Cybernetics seems perfectly reasonable. That video was of someone saying, think of the human as an information processing machine. A chemical machine, nevertheless a machine. Very useful. One of the theses in the book is that you can think of everything as information processing. Those of you who have read it thoroughly will know the last chapter is very, very peculiar. What does he argue in the last chapter? He says, because we're information processors, because we can reduce ourselves as an understood object, as that, then you can move up and realize certain sorts of problems. Because we're information processors, there will be limits to how much we can process. And his argument was that before the 1940s, society had reached a limit where there was so much information that there was more information than the people could deal with. And that meant they didn't understand it. And what would be the consequence? This is his argument in the last chapter, those of you who read it, the Second World War. His argument was people could no longer understand things. It was beyond their cognitive processing limits. And the science of cybernetics would let scientists manage information and information overload. It seems a long way from reducing a concept, so the concept of a person, to one thing, to going back up the socio-geographical politics of the Second World War. We get there. But this is not just old stuff. Think of Pendland. Think of his stuff about positive signals, honest signals, new stuff. People who reduce the human into an information processor still suffer when they try and reduce it up. Those of you know Pendland, the honest signals argument? I don't know. So, let's do a contrary example then. Okay, it won't take long. As part of the program of inquiries, they're thinking about how we might deal with communications overload. We engineered a little device. And the device turns around something which was perplexing, which is the video phone. Why was no one using a video phone? Nobody really wants to use video telephony on mobile devices to talk, to see each other, to communicate. Less seems to be better for them. Texting seems to be better than seeing, for example. But we thought there might be a way of solving this, and addressing a certain issue to do with interruption and overload. And this had to do with the following idea. When you're wanting to have a conversation with somebody, typically, when you're together, you glance at them. You look to see, say, if Ray's listening. In fact, he's listening, so maybe I could get him to speak. But sometimes, if we turn to somebody, they're scribbling, or they're on the phone. They're doing something. So, in other words, you glance to see whether it's appropriate to interrupt, to start a conversation. You can also modulate what you say by glancing. Oh, look, he looks upset. Oh, look, he's about to laugh on something. Will he tell me the joke? So we designed a little phone application called Glancing, which let you use a mobile phone to glance at others. Now, this sort of seems creepy, but it's not. It's very simple. This uses normal video telephony. But if you have a glance phone, you can put your phone in a glance mode. And the glance mode is not such that it can be glanced at when it's in your pocket, because what's the glancer going to see? It's going to be glanced useful when it does something different. So we made a little change in the design. I don't know if you can see at the back, but on the slider, there's little legs. And now you can put that phone on your desk. And just fell over. This is the broken one. Have I just broken it? Yeah, it is. There's one over here. I'll show you. I just broke this. So that you can put it on a little stand like that, and it becomes a tripod, like a little webcam. And as a webcam, when someone dials you, phones you, the dialogue on that will say, you can't interrupt them with a phone call, but you can glance them. Do you want to glance? You press yes. And a still image is taken. And when the glance is made, the recipient or the person who's been glanced at will have the caller, the glancer's name said to them. So if I try to glance my colleague, it would say, Richard. And then the glance would be made, and the glance is an instant image. Now, of course, you might imagine this might be a bit creepy. If you don't want to be glanced, you just close it, and it's not in glance mode. Put your phone down like that. But we had the idea that a glance phone might be useful, for example, when I'm doing a talk. I could put my phone in glance mode. People could glance me and say, I'm busy. So we did a trial, and what did we find? Let me show you. I could go on about the details of the trial, but it doesn't matter. The scenarios of use were just this. Interruptions, another scenario. Happy American families. This is an American company, obviously, so these are the images we have to use. Us working busily in our lab, not wanting to be interrupted. Okay? This is how we sold it to the managers to pay for the budget. But we've, in fact, got very little of these images glanced. These are copied glances. The one is of me in a meeting in Holland put it in glance phone mode because I thought people would like to see that I'm busy, so they could choose to interrupt me, but they could say I'm busy. This is me looking irritated in my office, probably designed to be glanced at. This is one of the engineers. This is the visitor, so that glance phone could see that we were busy. This is another one of the engineers. And very few images like that. No images that look like people glancing at situations where someone was busy. That's what I'm trying to say. What do we get? We get loads of images of this. A lady drinking beer. This is one of the designers. A glance into one of the most expensive Cambridge restaurants, as you know, might recognise it. One of the engineers dossing on his couch. How on earth could that be? What was going on? Now, I'm coming to my end, don't worry. What was happening here was that they were making reasons to communicate. So, if I go back, what we discovered after a few weeks was that people wouldn't use the glance phone to manage interruption. They would do quite the reverse. They would try an illicit interruption. So what they would do was, they would get people to glance at them. And the reasons why they would get them to glance at them was because they wanted to annoy the person who's doing the glancing. They wanted to mock the person doing the glancing. So this guy is, in fact, the guy who'd done the engineering and had gone home early while we were writing the report, which had to begin at midnight. So he made us glance him to see that he was doing bugger all. This was the designer who'd done her job when she went to a conference, not in Milton Keynes, in fact, in Bath. So she was getting us to glance her because she was saying, look how hard I'm working, guys. How did they do this? They discovered the users, when they were using it, was that if you tried to glance a glance phone, which wasn't in glance mode, nevertheless, it would say, Richard tried to glance. And what people discovered was if you tried to glance somebody else, even if their phone wasn't in the glance mode or not, they would know you tried or had glanced. People learned that actually it wasn't the first glance that was the issue, it was the glance back that was being demanded. In other words, it was, look at me. I will try and glance you so you can glance back at me. So when Stuart, did this, all of the people on the trial, all 12 people, glanced at him. He had a bundle of people looking at him. And likewise with Rachel. In other words, instead of glancing to manage interruption, I was waving. People were trying to draw attention to themselves. Now, what's this mean? So, what is communication? Getting back to our premise. So I could go on. Is it Locke, telementation thesis? I have something in here, I need to get it over there. Merely information, Shannon. Quine, Kantian argument, language object, all that stuff. Other arguments, cognitive need. Better way, it seems to me, is to stop the trap of conceptual muddles and just ask simple questions. What's a simple question? What kind of a culture practice? Why do people send a letter? Well, it's obvious. What is a letter? A letter is not a ponderous, slow, inefficient way of communicating. It is that, but it's something else which is more important. A letter is an epistle-like. Epistle-like in the sense that someone sorts themselves, settles down and says, I want to orchestrate my relationship, say, with my daughter, in my case. She's away, I want to write her a little letter. The letter is not, this is what's happening here. The letter is, this is what's happening here, and this is how I'm thinking about you. This is an attempt to alter the relationship between her and I, to create a kind of special whispered intimacy. But in the exchange of information, the nature of my relationship alters. I've honoured her. I've loved her. She's had to listen to me. As a teenager, that's a difficult thing. Nevertheless, she's achieved that. I know she's achieved that because she comments on the end of my letters to her. In other words, letters do something. Better to think of it than information here, not as information exchange communication, but as performative. These are the problems. Information processing capacity gets us some way, but can distract us. And we have a loads of language for that. I'm thinking about where I finish. Just think. Can you reduce these things to something other than that? How useful would it be? It is useful for certain questions. Shannon would not have come up with his engineering insights if he tried to network design systems for each of these things. He disregarded that. But if you want to ask, for example, what a species of information exchange is, human communication, then actually you have to be careful about how you have to think about it. And one of the things you have to recognise is that it's all these things and more. How can you reduce it? To what? So, you can put them in different terms to tell somebody something, to share information, can make a bond. I told you, you owe me. At work, gossip is vital. You hear things about someone departing. Last week we had a big departure in the lab, the gossip, the exchange, the information. Telling people about that in advance obliges them to tell me things about who's leaving this week, because as it happens, they will be still leaving. It creates a different, it's a bond, it's performative. The fact that information is exchanged is the device that lets something else happen, a bond. Okay? The result here, in my argument, is you have a texture of human relations with different sorts of ways of communicating. So the different sorts of forms of that, different sorts of human relationship, different forms of bond making. And this is my summary. My point here is that to understand human communication, it's not helpful to turn to Bateson. Emphatically not. It's better to turn to people like PMS Hacker, not people like Don Norman, who take those sorts of arguments. It won't get you anywhere. It'll get you somewhere, not necessarily somewhere you want to be, and it'll get you into difficulties. What Wittgenstein was concerned about in the 1930s and 40s, this is my peroration, was not an ontology of meaning. It was the desire to solve things, to rush to things, to tidy up, to clean things up, to fill up in empty spaces reason. And his particular concern was three disciplines. One wasn't quite a discipline. One was a discipline of philosophy, seeking to come up with abstract notions where no abstract notion was offering you any benefits. The other was psychology, where psychologists were seeking to fill up with arguments and concepts, spaces where no filling up was required. The third was in a newly invented trade called computer science, my science, where people like Turing came up with the idea that intelligence could just be a binary, either can or either can't, in which case a machine can do it. The point about this is that if we're thinking about the business of information, be careful. It's absolutely right sometimes to treat it this way. It's absolutely right to treat it in another way, in another sort of instance. My illustration has been, in this particular instance, to understand the problem of human communication overload, for example, don't treat communication as an information processing theoretic object. In other instances, some aspects of the human body and how it processes, you can treat it that way. People like Bateson don't know how to tread carefully. That's my contribution to the conference.